Be interesting.
There was one simple reason I invited him, which has something to do with the fact that he testified in an American court case.
Oh, is that why?
Yes.
To be honest with you, that wasn't the reason why I thought you did it.
That was the reason, because I was... I think you're also going to say something about this.
I will, but that's okay.
And he testified in a court case called Dover versus Kitzmiller, mm-hmm. On intelligent design, and in that court case, he testified as an expert witness in the American court, in part defending intelligent design. That wasn't the reason why I invited him, but the reason why I thought he might be an interesting person to invite is because I was a peer reviewer for a journal article which criticized his involvement in that case.
You're the one who allowed it to be published.
No, I wasn't. But what struck me about writing that peer review was that the critique of his involvement was kind of written in the name of, say, consistent positions within sociology of science and philosophy of science, although I, as a reviewer, thought that the critique actually was based much more on a sort of political denouncement of his position, which I can understand why you politically denounce the Fuller's position, but I found it a little bit odd that it was written so obviously as a kind of scientific critique, which it wasn't. And I found that it produced quite an interesting situation within social science of science and within the way how these issues are discussed, where it is often things are mixed up between normative positions and scientific positions, and he, by being an expert witness in that case, kind of put out a very strong test case for these questions. So this is what made me think about it, and which made me invite Steve Fuller, and I think we'll hear also quite a lot about this.
Okay, well, look, thank you, Michael, for inviting me, and thank you all for showing up. This is not the best time of the year to show up for a talk, I suppose. I must admit, in a way, it just shows how short people's memories are, that this is the thing I'd be invited for. I mean, because there's so many other things you could have invited me for that would have fit this category, and in a way, in a more interesting way. For example, I'm gonna begin this by saying, flagging a future publication. Some of you may know, if you're a reader of the journal Social Studies of Science, that next year there will be an issue that marks the 25th anniversary of both of Latour's Science in Action and the 50th anniversary of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Both of these things, as it turns out, are commemorated next year. And I was one of the people asked to write about either one. I decided to write about both of them very critically. And in a sense, that is kind of how I would more likely see myself put into this. I mean, some of you who have old enough institutional memories may know that in the year 2000, I published a very large, very critical book about the influence of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which is the most influential work on the theory of science, especially outside the scientific community, in at least the second half of the 20th century, if not the entire 20th century, when it gets down to it. Okay, and I was roundly condemned in the New York Times, and not everybody condemned me, I have to say, otherwise I wouldn't be here today. The point was that, in my mind, in terms of how I positioned myself, in terms of trying to pick fights, because I don't know how people have approached this topic, but if we're talking about my best fiend, I have to say, yeah, I'm a very belligerent, aggressive sort of person, and I believe progress is made in academia that way. So in a sense, I try to cultivate fiends. I don't know, maybe the rest of the people who've spoken here say, oh my God, how could anyone think that I could have said something so horrible, blah, blah, blah. No, I try to say horrible things. There are a lot of issues at play here. I want to flag two issues that are involved in my wanting to say horrible things and why I don't mind being fiendish in the way I conduct my intellectual life. One of them has to do with the way I sort of came into this business, why I thought it was worth pursuing. Some of you may know, in the great mists of time before perhaps some of you were born, I founded this journal called Social Epistemology in 1987. Okay, and I published the first book by that title in 1988. And the whole—if you look at the beginning of that book, already I was courting trouble because this was a period when you might say when the difference between the philosophy and sociology of science was very clearly marked. In the sense that philosophy of science was this normative discipline which still sort of adhered to a kind of big picture view that science is the progressive force in society, it's progressive in all kinds of respects, and in the sense what the history of science and the sociology of science ought to be doing is providing, as it were, the details to that, right? And so sort of Mertonian sociology of science would be the kind of sociology of science that would be aligned with this. And I was very much against that. Those of you who don't know, my PhD is in history and philosophy of science, right? It's not in sociology. So I'm someone who, you know, what is it? Crosswalking, crossbenching, whatever in the parliament, right? Goes from one side to the other, and that's already been a source of my fiendishness, right? I'm someone who is trained as a philosopher of science, who over the course of my career has always identified myself with the sociological side of things. Because basically, I believe, if you're going to have a normative position about the nature of science in society, that you've got to know something about society, and there's a sense in which the sort of basic general facts about society have to be a framework within which then norms get constructed. Okay, and that was something that was very much evident in my first book, Social Epistemology. That is what social epistemology means, as far as I'm concerned. Right, is in a way having a kind of historically and sociologically responsible normative theory of science. But the point is, where I disagreed with a lot of the historians and sociologists, and I think maybe I disagree with them today too, is I believe the idea of having a normative picture is very important. Okay, we live in a time where I think it's that in a sense the word science is used a little too casually. In the sense, and one of the ways you see the casualness of this is the fact that we quite happily move between talking about science and science says, right? And almost anything that anything that in the past would have been regarded as an authoritative knowledge practice, we pluralize it today as a way of sort of avoiding a difficult question. Because look, one of the things that we of course know from the history and sociology of science is that the things that we call sciences developed in many different contexts, in many different ways, in many different, you know, and we know all that, right? And so then there's a question down the road that says, why do we still call these things sciences? Right? I mean, especially if we're accentuating the diversity and the difference. And this is why, for example, Stephen Chapin, who I think is very much true to his views on this matter, right, I think maybe 15 years ago, wrote a book called The Scientific Revolution, where basically said it didn't happen. There was no such thing. And in fact, it's only a retrospective reconstruction that we call all those things that happened in the 17th century, in medicine, you know, in mechanics, in chemistry, and all these other places. We call them as somehow, we collect them together as scientific revolution, but what in fact happened were lots of different practices were changing in lots of different ways. And it's only for contemporary legitimating purposes that we call this a scientific revolution. Whereas, in fact, there is no unity, as it were, that these things share. There was no unified conception of an intellectual project or anything of that sort that was going on in the 17th century. That's Stephen Chapin's view. And so that's why this little book he wrote called The Scientific Revolution is a very radical book, right? And the interesting thing is the fact that we sort of see this as purely a history book, but I think this has a lot of... This should be knocking on our doors. Namely, is there something called science that in some sense we're interested in defending, reforming, whatever? My answer is yes, okay? My answer is yes. I think a lot of people who would call themselves historians and sociologists of science have already left the building, right? This is not their interest anymore. They're interested in documenting different practices in different places with different people, blah, blah, blah. But the term science is a normative notion doesn't mean anything to them. I mean, they're very polite about it. They don't actually say this out front. This is the thing I find very annoying about the way in which intellectual discourse happens today, is the fact that there are these kind of massive conceptual changes occurring, it seems to me, from broadly modern to postmodern perspectives don't really get argued. Rather, what you get is generational change. You get exactly the kind of story that Thomas Kuhn talked about in terms of how paradigm shift occurs in the structure of scientific revolutions. Right? The old people disappear. They're the ones for whom the problems were very vivid. And now you've got these new people on the scene who are totally ignorant of history, right? And so sort of believe whatever they're sold at the moment. And so for them, science doesn't have any normative freight at all. It's just kind of like a word. It's what the agents call themselves, right? And there's always a problem, I think, in sociology, especially in the more micro-sociology, where we take agents' accounts at face value. And we tend to sort of buy into agents' categories a little too quickly. And so as a result, you know, if agents use the word science, it doesn't matter what they mean, right? It means something, and so we're going to talk about that. Okay? Now, I think this is all just outrageous and so forth, and people detect that I think this is outrageous. And I've often believed, and I believe I'm correct in this, that in terms of the underlying antagonism that I've received from people in this field, beyond, you know, the intelligent design stuff, this predates the intelligent design stuff, it comes from this. Right, that there's a sense in which I do believe that there is something to be said for reconstructing the modernist project of science as the vanguard of society. And this is why when I was offered the opportunity to get some kind of named chair at Warwick University, I chose Auguste Comte. Because if anyone had that idea in mind, it was him. Okay, so this is kind of like a fuck you moment to critics. Auguste Comte, who would defend this man? I would. Okay? But the point is, you don't defend it on a priori grounds. You realize that, in fact, yes, there are all these facts on the ground that, as it were, argue against science in terms of, first of all, not only is science this kind of diverse project where, in fact, people don't sign up to the philosophical norms, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, there's all that. But also there's all of the, you know, adverse political consequences to have come from science in all kinds of ways. In the implementation, both deliberately and non-deliberately. And they're still happening today. And so, as it were, there's a large burden of proof to be borne by anyone who wants to advance the notion of science as the vanguard of social progress. Well, I think it's still a good idea to advance, and I realize the task is very difficult, but what makes it difficult also makes it very interesting. Okay? There are a lot of different fronts in which one needs to advance on this. But I don't give up the fight. Okay? And that's kind of where I'm coming from on this. And so I set myself up to be a foe of a lot of people. I mean, there are other aspects of this, too, I might just sort of toss in. One of them is, from the standpoint of the institutional politics of academia, I'm not the most clubbable guy in the world. Okay? Even though I do referee articles and books by people in many different fields, and perhaps some of you in the audience, and you may not know it, because it's not like people don't consult my judgment, but the fact is I'm not very strongly affiliated with any particular field, even the field in which I hold a chair, and I've held a chair now for 17 years. And so as a result, it's quite easy, I think, for people to sort of vent their antagonism to me publicly, you know, let's say in print and so forth, in the way they would to other people who they might worry about might be involved in deciding whether they end up getting promoted or something. Okay, so I do think I'm an easy target in that respect, because it's quite clear I'm not part of the establishment, I make a big point of that, and so a lot of issues that perhaps people might want to raise with regard to other people as well, they won't, they'll raise it about me. Okay? And I have to say that the most fascinating feature of all this, and of course the intelligent design controversy really brings this part out, is the emotiveness of it. You were alluding to this in the beginning. There's a real interesting kind of question here. So let's take intelligent design, okay? I got my PhD in history and philosophy of science. My PhD supervisor was arguably, you know, certainly one of the top five leading Newton scholars of his generation. I didn't do my PhD in Newton or anything like that, but nevertheless I took a lot of courses with him and I understood this and I understood what the scientific revolution was about. And anyone who knows anything from a historical standpoint about the scientific revolution knows that it's just totally theologically imbued with what we would now call an intelligent design perspective. And that science, as this kind of vanguard project, would never have got off the ground had not these people ended up having so much influence in various kinds of ways. It had nothing to do with churches. It had to do with a certain kind of ideology about human beings' relationship to God. No doubt about it. Because otherwise, you know, you think about it, if we just thought of ourselves as animals, why are we concerned about the origins of the universe? Why are we concerned about the, you know, internal workings of matter that we don't have any direct contact with? Right? I mean, the point is, these were people who thought of themselves as mini gods, gods in the making, creating the image and likeness of God, and they could understand everything the way God could, and that's what got science off the ground. There's no doubt about that. Okay? Thomas Henry Huxley even realized this at the end of the 19th century. He wrote delivered a very famous but puzzling lecture called Evolution and Ethics. What is the future of science going to be once we all internalize the Darwinian standpoint that we're just animals? Do we continue as we do in a kind of false belief? Or do we suddenly realize, my God, maybe we shouldn't be even having these ambitions to sort of understand the nature of the universe and everything, because there's no such possibility? Well, the point is, my point in saying all this is that I take at a reflexive level quite seriously the stuff I learned as the history of science as having application now. And that there is an issue about how you justify the pursuit of science in the way we've been pursuing it over the past half century, given all the undoubted death, destruction, you know, all the problems that science have caused and so forth, if we are not committed to this very fundamental idea that in some sense we're getting a grip on the nature of everything. Okay? And see, for the people in the scientific revolution and the people who you know, sort of buy the scientific worldview, that's sufficient, right? In the sense that justifies everything. But if you don't hold that view, if you believe you got to worry about how many people are dying because of implementing certain scientific views, then there's a real problem here. And that's why, in a sense, I always think that we should always have people like, you know, the radical ecologists breathing down our necks with regard to the future of science. Because, in a sense, those people understand what it means to be an animal. Right? And that we need knowledge that's appropriate for us as animals living with other animals on the planet. Not as would-be gods trying to make sense of everything. Okay? Now, you see, if you say all this stuff very openly, it creates enormous amounts of problems. Because, in a sense, I think people today live with a very schizophrenic kind of perspective. It's maybe even more than schizophrenic, plurisphrenic, you know, whatever. Namely, we're quite happy to say, in the past, Newton and all those scientific revolution guys were intelligent design people. We're quite happy to say that. We grant that point. But it has no relevance to now. Why? Well, because science justifies itself because of the way it works. Yeah, the way it works? Well, yeah. You're only looking at the good side. There's also the bad side. What if you'd actually did a complete balance sheet on this? You know, would science come out looking so good? You see, it's not so obvious. Okay? It's not so obvious. And so you really do need to have a normative perspective to justify what at the empirical level may look very ambiguous. And the problem is people don't want to get involved in this kind of discussion. Okay? And I think this is, in a sense, part of what the intelligent design controversy is about, is that there's a sense in, you know, there's a sense in which, well, how seriously do you take the fact that science has developed the way it has? How seriously do you take it in terms of the relevance that it has today for understanding and legitimating why science is the way it is? My view is we haven't come up with a good alternative yet, other than saying that somehow we're godlike. And I think the way we're operating now in terms of more progressive parts of science, where we're re-engineering the genome and all these other things that we're trying to do at the moment, the best explanation for all of that behavior, insofar as we look at it in a positive light, is that we think of ourselves as becoming created beings like God. I really do, and everybody hates me for that. Okay? I don't think there's really a better explanation for that. If you want to talk about it, it's something that ought to be pursued outside of the self-interest of the particular people who in the short term make money out of it. Now, the answer that you get from a lot of science studies people, of course, is to say, this stuff is just bullshit. Right? People are claiming to be able to do all kinds of things, but what we need to look at is just the discourse and the fact that discourse doesn't really pan out the way people intended to and so forth. And of course it doesn't in the short term. None of these hyped up things ever pan out in the short term, but that's too short term a perspective from which to look at the efficacy of this. Okay? It seems to me that you've got to look in terms of the way in which investments are going to go, in which people's thinking is going to go. You have to look at how things are going to happen in the next 100 years and so. And then you start to see, because what looks like is total pipe dreams and just speculations on the part of people like Ray Kurzweil today, you know, 100 years from now, even if not what exactly he says comes true, people will, I think, start to live lives that, you know, are amenable to this. Okay? And I think this is very much true if you look at the history of science, that we are moving in this different direction where we're redefining what humanity is, and that the people in science studies ought to be doing more than just recording what people are saying and then offering, whenever they offer anything that's vaguely normative, to just be dismissive. Because in a sense, people are moving in this direction. And so that's the other part of the story. What normative means. It seems to me science studies is very much in a rut with regard to the normative. It's critical in the mere sense of critical. See, I understand critical as part of a larger dialectical movement, where in a sense you have an initial position, then you have the second moment of the dialectic, which is the critical moment, where you show all the shortcomings of the original position. And that is kind of what I was doing when I put forward the notion of social epistemology. You know, you show the weaknesses of all the positions on the table, but then the challenge is to go forward with something positive that can actually incorporate the difference, the different positions that are there. That's the challenge. In that respect, I'm very much on board with Hegel. Okay? And Marx, and people like that. Where in a sense, there is good and there's bad, and the issue is going to be, how do you separate the wheat and the chaff, and then put it together in some sort of larger synthetic moment, if you believe that there is some sort of common project of humanity or society that we're moving toward. Now, of course, people may just have given up on this a long time ago. In which case, then, I realize this is like, I'm talking to the deaf. But this is where I'm coming from here, okay? And this is what's motivated all of the ways in which I've sort of operated in society. Yeah?
Isn't it not more that people haven't given up on it so much as that people have said, partly inspired by Kuhn, that a kind of demarcationist philosophy of science is actually not one that's going to deliver?
Yeah. No, I agree.
So isn't it that, you know, the kind of critical philosophy of science that you're hoping for has become a problem conceptually,
yeah,
historically?
No.
So, I mean, it's just because you say, well, all these people don't want to get involved with me or with the issues I want to debate. But I'm curious, you know, I'm wondering, are you wanting to get involved with these kinds of problems?
Look, one of the things that's really striking about science studies today, in terms of if one talks about the sense in which science studies is involved with the sociology of science, the real absent player in most science studies discussions is the university. Okay? Science studies is the last place I would go to understand anything about the university. I can understand, if I want to understand labs, oh yes, right? I mean, if I want to understand specific places where knowledge is produced and distributed among people who can do something with it, you know, in some sort of self-organizing way, yes, but not the university. You see, this is why, as the years have gone on with regard to my critique of Kuhn, that one of the things that I thought was problematic about Kuhn was not that he believed that paradigms were autonomous forms of knowledge that developed on their own accord. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that it was just very narrowly discipline-based. And I think what you actually need is an institution that is dedicated to knowledge as a kind of autonomous but vanguard activity, which is what the modern university a la Humboldt in the early 19th century was about, where the university, right, would, as it were, be the site where all the different forms of knowledge are integrated into a collective whole for purposes of delivering them to human beings so they can be empowered. Okay?
That was the 19th century.
Well, I'm sorry, universities still pay lip service to this idea insofar as...
Seriously, there have been, in 20th century philosophy of science, like in the work of Isabel Stengers, very serious attempts to develop a kind of a coherent perspective on the sciences, plural meaning natural sciences, social sciences, cultural sciences, which take very seriously this task of developing a coherent view of the institutions.
Look,
the sciences,
okay,
so
yes.
To just refer back to a 19th century ideal and say, well, that's what we need to engage with.
Well, she's engaging with the 19th century too. Look, we're all engaging with the 19th century in this respect. Okay, so let's not talk about the 19th century as the problem here. I mean, I think the thing is, how do you expect such a vision to be delivered? Okay? And my view is, I mean, and this is where I do think the Humboldt idea is, and this is where philosophy played actually a very important sociological role in the early modern era, which has been completely abandoned, which was the idea, philosophy, as it were, the discipline of general education, was the place where all the different bodies of knowledge were integrated together and delivered to a student who may not be a specialist in any of those forms of knowledge, but could take something from all of them in whatever, you know, role they performed in society. Okay? And so there was always this idea of Goethe as kind of the model, right? The kind of polymath, the person who kind of knew enough about everything and then integrated it and made a very unique contribution to society on the basis of that. Okay? I think that's still a very attractive image. Okay? And I think that is the conceptual principle on which a university ought to be organized. Now, admittedly, it has to be updated in all kinds of ways, because even when, you know, when Humboldt was talking, the laboratory sciences weren't part of the university. But it seems to me that, is, you know, if you want to talk about a concrete way in which one could talk about unified knowledge, empowering people, and so forth, we're talking about general education in the curriculum, okay? As something citizens should go toward as in a way, you might say, the ultimate finishing school. Bildung. Right? Which is what Bildung is really, you know, the finishing school. Where Homo sapiens becomes human. I do think there is still something to that. The constitution of that curriculum and the way you go about doing it, there's a lot to be said. I mean, you know, that need to change. So, for example, I'm one of these people who's been very receptive, for example, about technology, you know, and media and stuff like that. And obviously, Humboldt didn't have any of that sort of stuff in mind. He was talking about speaking and writing, you know, in the sort of usual sense of the term. But I think that that's the sense, and if you want to talk about science, you know, as in a way, a socially progressive force, that's the institutional setting in which it manifests itself. That's my point. Now, you know, people can start making gestures and saying there's lots of stuff happening in many different places and so forth, but I want to know what the overall effect is. You see, because one of the things that was very much true of even the German university system in the 19th century was it managed to pluck out, maybe not as much as it should, but pluck out, you know, poor, able people through examinations and so forth, and actually managed to sort of organize the society on the basis of that. I mean, that's why over a course of a couple of generations, Germany became this, you know, sort of intellectually supreme nation and so forth. I don't think that's a trivial point. Okay? In terms of empowerment of people through knowledge. And I just don't see the discussion these days really organized in that fashion. I mean, because largely, I don't see, you know, especially with the death of socialism, I don't see any obvious kind of organizing category that people would want to have everyone be educated toward. I mean, clearly in Humboldt's day, it was, you know, sort of the nation state was the organizing principle, and we may find the nation state to be a very invidious thing. Socialism was talking about the world, the human population and such, but socialism's in disrepute now. Okay, maybe it's not, you know, yeah, hope springs eternal, I understand. But the point is, socialism definitely needs a vehicle, and what made socialism successful in the 19th to 20th century was the fact that it did have vehicles. It had parties, that's one of the interesting things. The sociology of socialism is something we can learn a lot from, because those people knew how to do stuff. They knew how to get action, they organized reading groups. I mean, I would refer you, by the way, if you want to know, you know, if you want to study this empirically or whatever, or maybe get inspiration for today, there was this book that came out in 1989 by Robert Wuthnow, who's a sociologist of religion at Princeton University, called Communities of Discourse, which was basically about the three main, you might say, intellectually led revolutions in the West in the modern period, starting with the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and socialism. Okay, and what he does is he studies, exactly how you get people, you know, who previously were illiterate or disinterested and so forth, organize and mobilize and reading texts and relating the text in certain ways, and then using the text as the basis for action. And there's a lot of organization. It's very interesting to see how this happens in the detail, okay? It's more than just kind of, you know, tweeting people for a few minutes and they all show up in one place and get a photo op and then disappear again, okay? Which is a bit like what happens today, it seems to me. I mean, how do you actually go from, you know, low, you know, sort of micro scale forms of organization to these large-scale social transformations. They have been engineered by intellectuals. Okay? It's not, it's, you know, and this is the other point. You know, people just have to be willing to put in the, but this is what the thing of the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and Marxism, socialism shows, is that these things can happen. I just don't think, in a sense, we live in a time where people have enough overarching belief in such things to want to commit the effort. Okay? And I think that's kind of where we are at the moment. But saying this kind of stuff is incredibly unpopular. You know, not only because, you know, of our neoliberal times and all the rest of it, but because of, you might say, the sort of the shadow politics of neoliberalism, which is postmodernism. Okay, I hate to say that. I know some of you like postmodernism, but it seems to me, you know, this is kind of, this is the politically correct version of neoliberalism. You know, and so in that respect, you know, this is what, you know, and so I thought, for example, you know, when I gave the initial title of the talk, I mentioned Latour. You know, who's like the poster boy for this, right? You know, and so it seems to me that but you see, you know, in terms of the fiendishness of it, you know, I think there's a sense in which people like Latour, as Kuhn did in an earlier period, are basically riding on the zeitgeist. They're riding on the, you know, the sort of culture of the times. And this is where I think, you know, something about my own sociology is important. Because look, I am a tenured professor. I'm not, I mean, some of you may be, some of you may not. But the point is, I'm institutionally secure, relatively speaking. I can make these kinds of noises that perhaps a lot of you in the audience can't make, and so you're all forced to become actor network theorists. Right? Because actor network theory, you know, is like protective coloration. It's the ultimate chameleon discourse, right? So you can move in and talk about theory when you need to, and you can start, interpolating and intercalating, you know, with what? Deleuze and Whitehead and Bergson and whatever flavor of the month dead person is around. You know, but on the other hand, you know, you can also get grants. Right? Because one of the things that actor network theory does is it unveils a lot of empirical stuff that people might not notice otherwise if they weren't working with its concepts. Okay? And so you can play it both ways. And we now live in an academic culture. If you do not have a regular, secure academic post, then you've got to play the game both ways. You've got to be a neoliberal half the time, and you've got to be like a serious Humboldtian the other half of the time. Okay? And actor network theory is the ideal theory for you. I completely understand why this theory is so popular. It has nothing to do with the intellectual merits of it, because it's purely derivative at an intellectual level. Okay? I mean, and in fact, how do I know it's intellectually derivative? Because of the way in which people can so easily show connections between it and other things. You know, it's a bit like Slavoj Žižek, only it's professional Slavoj Žižek, right? Where it says, if you read the books he read, you could just do what he does. There's nothing really new here. You know, it only seems amazing if you're philosophically illiterate. Which, of course, a lot of sociologists are. You know, I do think that one needs to really kind of, you know, this is why I'm a fiend, okay? I say shit like this. But the point is that, you know, while all this stuff is going on, and it's inevitable that there will be these various intellectual fashions taking place, I mean, no one denies this. It's, there's really no point after a while dumping on Latour, because in a sense, you know, he disappears and someone else will replace him, right? I mean, there isn't really an issue there. The issue is, what is it that you want to be defending at the end of the day as all these fashions are passing? And you see, because I'm someone who's committed my life to being an academic, and this is where I think, you know, at the end of the road, I'm going to turn out to be Max Weber or somebody like that, you know, in the sense that I identify very strongly with the university as an institution, and I'm really trying to articulate what is the appropriate normative stance for someone who is, who believes, you know, in science as a vocation, right? What should you be now in the 21st century? Okay, and it's for sure what you shouldn't be is a multiply flexible feast, which I think is what a lot of academics are these days. And I don't blame them individually, because the incentive structure by which we recognize academics is very much geared in this direction, whether we're talking about citation counts or grants or whatever, right? There is a sense in which we have gotten assimilated into the fashion culture. Okay, and in a really deep way. And, you know, just look at the research assessment exercise, where in a sense, not only do you need to have published, but you need to actually have had impact within a 4 to 5 year period. Now, that is diabolical. Think about it. It's like the ideal piece of research in Britain today would basically be self-consumed in 4 years or 5 years. So in other words, you know, because you're not, you know, now this issue is being addressed somewhat by saying, oh, you can have retrospective impact, you know, from stuff published 10 to 15 years ago. Well, I'm sorry, you know, it's a bit late in the game, and it also just shows you how the bias was put into the system. That we have a system where the ideal form of research is you do it now, and it gets recognition now, and then it disappears so that you're forced to do something else in the future that can get you at least a similar amount of recognition. How do you get any kind of cumulative form of knowledge of any kind of depth that way? Okay? Now, I realize people who are caught up in the system as short-term contract researchers cannot complain about this, because this is the life that they are sucked into and they're forced to. But people like me, right, you know, who even if, you know, I get my knuckles wrapped or something like that, still have a job and so forth, it's responsibility of people like me to make this kind of noise. Okay, because I do believe there's worth something defending here. What worries me very often is that there are a lot of tenured professors, academic colleagues, who don't believe there's anything worth defending here. You know, who in a sense don't like the neoliberal regime, but on the other hand, you know, they're just pure cynics. Right? So they say, well, you know, look, all of that Humboldtian stuff nobody really lived up to anyway. So, you know, come on, it's bullshit. It's all bullshit, you know? I mean, you hear a lot of these older people talking this way. You know, it's worse than what the young people do. Because they're not showing any leadership, not showing any direction whatsoever. Okay? But the point is, if you try to, then, you know, you open yourself to stuff. You open yourself to all kinds of things. And I have to say, for those of you who are kind of the frame of mind and say, hey, I can take a lot of people hating me and so forth, the good part about this is the more people that hate you, the less each additional hater counts. Really. I think that's a really important point. You know, so that when you get the first really bad review or the first really kind of, you know, someone thinks, you know, we should revoke your PhD, as he's been told to me, by Thomas Kuhn. When I interviewed Thomas Kuhn as part of this big book I did, right? Because you know, and I thought I was doing him a favor by sending him the stuff I'd already written about him. You know, so he knew what to prepare himself for. Okay, I was going to his house to do this, and the guy basically, you know, this is a great point. I said, look, I'm not going to record this because I want you to feel completely comfortable, and I don't want to, you know, do anything that you're going to be suspicious of, because you know I'm very critical of you, blah, blah, blah. So you bring in any recording material. He had tape recording. It's still there in his archive somewhere, right? Kind of, you know, 1996 little kind of tape recorder, a literal tape recorder. And he began, actually, by reading a text saying that my PhD should be revoked. Okay? That's a bit harsh, of course. I mean, luckily I was just about tenured. I had just got tenured then, so it wasn't so bad. But that was a very harsh thing to begin with. But it gives you a sense that you have to be able to put up with stuff. And then after that, everything else, you know, is easy. Okay? And you start to get used to things like, you know, when people review your books and they're so outraged by the first chapter, they don't bother to see what you say at the end, you know, this kind of stuff. But that's a luxury that comes with, you know, not only being hated a lot, but also having tenure and being able to withstand that sort of thing, okay? And I think that to a certain extent, if you want to defend some sort of larger ideal about knowledge, and you're institutionally well-positioned to do so, I think you're really squandering your academic freedom if you don't. In other words, there is a sense in which if you don't cultivate enemies, you're not doing your job if you're a tenured academic. I really believe that. Okay? Because you can do it without being fired. You know, what's the worst that can happen? You don't get a raise. What happens? You don't win an award from a professional society that you probably think is pretty artificially constructed anyway. So the point is that for those of us who are in any position comparable to mine, right, this is the way you should be cultivating fiends. I mean, I'm always very suspicious of people who have, you know, enormous amount of seniority and power and everybody loves them. You know, especially they love them for something they did a long time ago. He said, what have you been doing in the interim, collecting the check? I mean, what are you doing? You know, I mean, you're not really pushing yourself. It's like, you know, when Robert De Niro shows up as a bit part in all sorts of second-rate films, right? This is kind of how you think about a lot of these, you know, older academics. It's a bit like that, right? Where they're just sort of, after a while, they become parodies of themselves. And see, this is the and I think a lot of the younger people pick this up, and this is why they think the whole tenure and, you know, permanent job in academia thing should completely be eradicated. Because the whole talk about academic freedom, you know, and challenging the norms of society because you've got this protective space to do so, most academics don't do it. They don't do it. They just sort of sit back and they cruise. You know, and I think people realize that after a while, and they become very cynical about the value of such a thing. But that's never been my style, okay? That's never been my style. If I thought, and this is why I always have very mixed feelings about what the future of academia is, because sometimes I think, yeah, just blast, you know, get rid of all sorts of departments, you know? What we need is a real massive sea change. See what happens then. Especially when you see people who are just sort of cruising along, citing each other, blah, blah, blah. You feel like, yeah. Get rid of it. But I haven't said that in public yet. Well, I have now. But no, I mean, so there is a sense in which some of the more nihilistic things, and any of you who have any kind of serious career in academia, if you have a conscience, you realize what I'm saying is true. One other thing I want to bring up here is that from the standpoint of the history of all this, because one thing, again, you didn't mention in your introduction, and again, some of you may be too young to remember, there was this thing called the science wars, right? I mean, so I did this social epistemology thing, I did this thing on Kuhn, but there was this whole thing going on in the 1990s called the science wars. You know, it was kind of reached a peak in the mid-1990s, kind of petered out by the beginning of the 2000 period. This was a real big deal, and this really made a big difference with regard to how the fields that I'm in start to conduct themselves, okay? And from my standpoint, I think our side lost. This is the thing about the Sokol hoax. You familiar with the Sokol hoax? Most of you must have at least heard of it, right? So you get this guy, this physicist at New York University, publishing this very... Hey, thanks for showing up. Yeah. Publishing this very articulated article about... what, the transgressive hermeneutics of quantum field theory or something, I think it was the title of the piece. And this was in the journal Social Text, which at the time was probably the leading cultural studies journal in North America, has enormous numbers of footnotes, very well, you know. And Sokol was known by, Sokol was a friend of the editor Andrew Ross at New York University, and so was known as a guy who had politically correct views. You know, he taught mathematics to the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. You know, I mean, you know, how much better can you get than that in terms of credentials for talking about the transgressive hermeneutics of quantum mechanics? But the point was what Sokol, who's a mathematician, right, and a physicist, fabricated the citations and did a lot of bullshit stuff, but interlaced it with all of the, you know, Irigaray and Deleuze and, you know, the usual suspects who are kind of riffing metaphorically on a lot of this, you know, modern math and physics stuff. And then after the thing appeared, the day after Sokol goes to the New York Times, it's a front page story, 1996, saying, look at these frauds, they have no standards, and all kinds of nightmare happens. Latour, by the way, got caught up in this. Again, you may not remember, but he was a candidate to be a permanent part of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, and that got nuked on the back of this. And so there were all kinds of things, all kinds of fallout from this. Now, from the very beginning, because I was contacted by the New York Times about this when this broke, I wasn't having it, because it's interesting how science studies has responded to this over the years, okay? My basic view, which I said very early on, and I articulate most explicitly in the book called The Philosophy of Science and Technology Studies, is that, first of all, that you don't actually need to get the science right in order to actually say something about the science that has epistemic merit. Okay? You can get some facts wrong and everything, but if you get some basic concepts and basic ideas and you manage to get them put into the culture, even if they do not stand up to the kind of scrutiny, you know, where Sokol is basically saying, Deleuze says this, it is wrong. He wrote this book afterwards, you know, the Impostures book with Bricmont, where he goes through all of these French post-structuralist guys and shows, you know, paragraph by paragraph how they get all the science wrong. My view is it doesn't matter. Let them get the science wrong. The interesting thing, because this is not the first time this has happened in the history of thought, we're actually getting the details about the science wrong, extrapolating wildly from the context in which it originates, actually is very interesting, very important, very significant. So yes, it's always unfortunate when people get stuff wrong, but that's a very limited fault. It's kind of like a spelling error. It isn't a massive conceptual error indicative of intellectual dishonesty or something like this. That's my view. It's still my view today. That there's a sense in which this was something that was over. And what surprises me even the most is the way in which the people at Social Text and a lot of the postmodernists just rolls over. They apologize. They kind of, you know, did all kinds of hand-waving. There was this interesting article that came out in the Journal of Critical Inquiry a few years ago. John Guillory, who's maybe some of you know about this guy, who was basically saying, well, you know, what the social text Sokol hoax shows is that really, you know, science studies and all these things are about discourse, about what people say. They don't actually engage in the ontological issues in any kind of direct way. They don't really engage in the epistemological issues. They're just reporting what other people say. You know, and so they can kind of get away with that. And as long as we keep that boundary enforced, then we can have friendly relations with the sciences. Okay? I thought, wow, this is like the Vichy moment of science studies. Okay? It's the Vichy moment of science studies. It seems to me that we really did get this wrong, okay, in terms of the way we responded to the whole Sokol hoax business. We should have just said, yes, people get stuff wrong when they're speaking outside their field. True. It's good of you to mention it. Fine. But it still does not undermine the general points that are being made. Okay? And this is the problem. When these little points that get made, and they're the easiest thing in the world to do if you're really aiming at it, right, don't matter in terms of the larger point. And if you can't say anything about the larger point, you should shut up. You should stick to being a fact checker and spell checker, which is what essentially Sokol was, okay, with regard to a lot of these French guys. So, what amazes me is the fact that there wasn't a real pushback against this to this day. And the other thing, too, was I was also very surprised, and this is from a more sort of sociological empirical standpoint, the extent to which people didn't raise all of the frauds that go on in science that take forever to be detected. Okay? So, for example, the interesting thing about the Sokol hoax was the fraud was announced by the person who committed it pretty much the day after the thing got published. But there are frauds that go on in science for 2 or 3 years and nobody notices it. Okay? And so there was, in fact, it's another issue I talk about in the book, The Philosophy of Science and Technology Studies, about there was this guy in Switzerland, the name escapes me at the moment, who published all of these amazing articles on nanotechnology and science and nature in the late 1990s, and it turned out to be a total hoax. It took 4 years to figure this out, the most important scientific journals in the world. Okay? And this is a hoax too, it's a really serious hoax, much more serious than what Sokol had discovered. And you know, there have been other hoaxes since then in science, and people don't get so exercised in this way. Okay? And so I do think, you know, there's a sense in which the science wars, one of the consequences of it, it seems to me, was that the kind of assertive, you know, sometimes critical, not always critical, but assertive role that science studies played with regard to defining the role of science in society really disappeared after the science wars. Right? Science studies became more this kind of field that was kind of, you know, trying to mesh more with maybe philosophy, other fields, but kind of taking a back seat, in a way, from the kinds of public assertions that it was associated with in the 1980s and 90s. And I think that's a real disappointment. And you see, my involvement in the intelligent design controversy in the 2005 is in a way doing exactly the kind of thing that these guys did not want to have done again. In a sense, I was kind of reviving all the reasons why the science wars began in the first place by doing what I did. Because my point in speaking in the science wars, I was asked as an expert witness on the history and philosophy of science about whether intelligent design has ever contributed to the development of science. That was kind of the context in which I was brought in. And my answer was absolutely yes. There's no question. Now, the other person who was actually a classmate of mine at the University of Pittsburgh, Robert Penick, who was an expert witness on the same issue for the other side, he just said, no, never, no, you know. That religious stuff that people like Newton had, that was just like a mental aberration or something. I don't know. Maybe people evolved out of it by the 19th century. So he completely denied it. I actually think I was absolutely right, and I think it's still a very important issue today to continue raising. Now, I got roundly condemned by this. In fact, an entire issue of the journal Social Studies and Science devoted to condemning me on this matter. Which just shows you how some people just don't have life. And the editor of the journal, who became the president of the Society for Social Studies and Science, Michael Lynch, if you actually look at what it boils down to, what the objection is basically the fact that I didn't take the side of the winners. I didn't take the side of the people who should have won the case. You know, and what I did was I actually took my own view. I was voicing my own agenda on the proceedings. Yeah, duh, yes, that is exactly what I was doing. I don't decide whether to participate in a case as an expert witness because I'm interested in whether my side is likely to win. That's not how I make these judgments, okay? I make it in terms of what it is that I can say, you know, honestly and truthfully, that would be helpful in the situation with regard to the issues at stake. It's up to the lawyers to decide what happened, and the judge, and so all the rest of it. I was quite happy. In fact, I made a calculated judgment. Let's put it this way. If I was not tenured, if I were actually living in the United States, I would not have done this. It's true. It was a calculated judgment. It was helpful that I lived here, and I was tenured, and I figured people will dump on me, but in the end, you take a little bit of grief. So, for example, some parents called up, you know, because even before I had returned to the UK after testifying, The Guardian had a page three story saying I'd done this. And the parents were calling me and saying, we're never going to send our students to Warwick University. Yeah, but that only goes on for a couple of days. If you can withstand that, yes, do it. And I'm quite happy to have done so, because I think what I've done, Michael Lynch says, I've confused the issue, and I've presented a very bad image of what science studies people are like when they're in the public. I said, no, I've complicated the issue in a very useful way. Because there is a lot of complication here to be put out there, and someone's got to be in a position to do that. This is not such a straightforward issue as it seems. Okay? And I realize not everybody's in a position to do this, but I felt that I was in a position to do this. And that is part of the ethic under which I operate. Namely, if I'm in a particular position because of whatever my training or my institutional location or whatever, if I'm in a particular, where I have a kind of, you know, comparative advantage in saying certain things, I will do it. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not too worried about whether I believe the details of the intelligent design theory that's being promoted. That is actually a secondary concern as far as I'm concerned. What's of concern to me is putting something out there in the public domain that needs to be known and needs to be discussed by people. Okay? And then we take the argument forward collectively. And I think that's a very responsible attitude, public intellectual attitude, for an academic to take. And we are in a position where we can take the flak if we have these secure academic positions. And if we don't take advantage of this, those of us who are professors, then I wonder why are we drawing these enormous paychecks? You know, if we're not actually taking these risks that other people cannot take. Because I do think that's the luxury. That's the luxury of being a professor at the end of the day, is the potential for risk-taking. A sort of certain kind of securitized risk-taking in the intellectual realm. And if we don't take advantage of that, then we're not really worth our money. And I can understand why people want to get rid of tenure and stuff like that under the circumstances, because very few academics actually take this up. Okay, and I always think in the back of your mind, you may agree or disagree with my substantive views on the matter, but I think the thing that you really need to think about is the pose, is the posture, is the stance. you know, given the institutional position that I have, what is it someone like me should be doing? Given, you know, my background, my training, my understanding, what is it that I should be doing? Okay, should I just be engaged in the feather bedding business, you know, where I'm just sort of basically propping up all the other people who propped up me, and, you know, we just sort of go on and on, backslapping forever? You know, I mean, it's not necessary. You don't have to live that way. I'm living proof of that. Okay? And I think, actually, that society, in the end, benefits by going out there and actually cultivating enemies when it gets right down to it. Not gratuitously, of course. I'm not saying you just go around insulting people, you know, whenever you feel like it. But I do think there are targets. You know, you and you'd have to decide this for yourself. Targets of opportunity where you're very well positioned to really launch an attack on something that's just taken as given, or where there's a kind of a silence around it that nobody wants to bring up because they, you know, they feel that they'll be offensive. Okay? I think I'll stop here. And then we'll open it up to more questions. I want to thank whoever this person is who was sitting there, who was so bold to actually intervene at the time. I really appreciated that. I mean, the rest of you could have done that.
Great. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. And the floor is open for comments, questions. So, please.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually mentioning about the sociologists of turning into pay-as-you-go researchers. But I'm learning the language now. I would love you to make a sentence with greed. No, Paul, actually. Relativism. Scientific development. And... belief.
Creed.
Belief, creed, scientific development, and relativism.
It's interesting you mentioned those, because I don't relate to those words very easily. Let me ask you a question. I mean, why did you put those four words together? Because they're not words that I kind of really... I realize other people who criticize me bring these words up, but I don't particularly... I mean, so, for example, I don't think myself as a relativist, for example.
No, I don't actually see you as a relativist. Relativism, I have seen relativism very in the core, in the center of the sociological studies that you've written.
Yes, true.
All the people want to be the goody. They deny, you know, they afford to have a standpoint.
Yeah. I know, it's true. It's
and
true.
And also, yeah, you can make a paragraph from the others.
Okay, well, look. I think here a lot has to do with the fact, I mean, you know, if you look at the history of the sociology of scientific knowledge and, you know, from which this modern sociology of science comes from, it was pretty much an anti-philosophical movement, in the sense that philosophy stood for a normative perspective, right? And I think there were a lot of issues kind of conflated there in the beginning. A lot of it, I think, was kind of, you might say, sort of right-on anti-imperialism that the philosophers were associated with. You know, you impose this kind of scientific worldview on the people and so forth. But the people who were actually advancing those views didn't really have that kind of political spirit when it got right down to it. The relativism became not a kind of reaction to some sort of hegemonic thing, but rather a purely methodological principle by which you understand whoever you're studying, pure, you know, using their terms, their categories, as the primary anchor point, you know, from which your stuff comes about. So it becomes this, and if you turn it into a methodological principle, then you have a chance of actually developing a discipline and a paradigm and things of that kind. But even when the academic structure starts to fall apart, you still remain kind of useful, because methodological relativism as a kind of tool to find out about what people in societies you don't really understand are doing is very useful. Okay, I mean, and in fact, you know, even before, you know, the sociology scientific knowledge, if you look at the way in which micro sociology developed, especially in the United States in the 20th century, right, you get all, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation, the United States government funding a lot of these guys, you know, symbolic interactionists, people of this kind,
to actually find out what subcultures are up to, you know, because they're sort of opaque with regard to the larger general issues. And I do think there's some of that, you know, that ends up making a lot of that sort of relativism still very marketable as a pure instrument to finding out about cultures that are otherwise very difficult to get at. Because you sort of suspend your beliefs and you suspend your attitudes and you can get a kind of better sense. And then, of course, but the question is, for whom is that knowledge? And the knowledge is for the paymaster. Right? I think that that's where, the relativism slides into the neoliberalism in our own time. You know, to be honest with you, I think unless you change the political economy of knowledge production, it's going to be very hard to get rid of that. Because I think it's very well adapted. That kind of thing is very well adapted to the current political economy of knowledge production. This guy here. Oh, sorry.
I have a very quick, probably boring question. When you were talking about, I think, socialism and sort of, you said that there was an intellectual designer for this way that, I just wanted to get that name and maybe the book.
Which? Wisnow. You're talking about Wisnow. Ah, okay. Yeah, maybe I should put that up there. Is there some kind of marker here? You got some technology 1.0 here? Yes, that's the guy. Robert Wisnow, he's at Princeton University, still alive. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, it's a book that came out in 1989.
Way before you were born.
And it's called Communities of Discourse, and it's about the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and socialism. It is really worth, because he does a kind of cross-national thing, and he looks at the way in which the institutions developed. It's really very, I find it very useful. I would, you know, any of you who are thinking about starting a global movement and really wanted to stick, you should read this book. Seriously. No, because Reformation, Enlightenment, Socialism, those are the benchmarks. Okay?
Yeah. Well, that leads nicely onto my question. So I got told at a conference last week I've got a chip on my shoulder. And so I'm now, after your talk, I'm starting to think that this was actually a compliment. Thanks for bringing up these questions. And thanks for bringing up some of the kind of bigger questions that don't always get talked about. I'd like to pick you up on the on the idea of reading groups leading to social change.
Yeah.
I thought that was a joke at first, but I take it that actually...
With Marx, yes, with the Bible, and you go through these things, yes.
It's a general question about the role of academia in activism.
Okay, well, look, here's the thing, and this is the downside of what if you really take this seriously, academia is usually the enemy, okay? But what the progressive people need to do is to reinvent, in their own way, the better aspects of academia, okay? And so the idea of the reading groups, for example, which is very much characteristic of the Reformation, especially the Reformation and socialism, where people would read the Bible together and people would read Marx together. I mean, that's actually quite a significant thing in terms of getting the ideas transmitted. There was a discipline to that, right? So after people worked, they would get together at night, you know, and so forth. And if you look at a lot of the rhetoric surrounding it, it was kind of like, you know, a sort of shadow university, a kind of a virtual university, you know, kind of the real university where the values of the university were really being maintained, which weren't being maintained in the actual universities. Because I think one of the things that is common to the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and socialism is a kind of a very uneasy and often tense, you know, negative relationship with universities because they're the establishment. Right, because typically, especially if you're looking from the period of the 16th century to the 19th century, universities are the place where the elites are trained, very often the elites, the clerical elites, you know. And these are the people who basically are just reproducing the dominant ideology of the society. So you know, but that doesn't mean you have to be anti-intellectual, right? On the contrary, what you need to do is preserve what's valuable, but in this new form. And if you know, I think a very interesting thing is to look at... when Protestants talk about what a church is, you know, so when you get the Protestant discussion of church, and you look at when the Marxists talk about what a party is, then there are university-like things to these entities as they conceptualize them, okay? Where they're trying to, you know, admittedly, as the years go on, they don't necessarily retain them. But in the origin, the idea is to create a kind of shadow institution that has the best of what the university has without the kind of hegemonic structures attached to it.
Well, Occupy London Paul's has just set up its own university at the building they've occupied.
You see, that's a very, that's a very, see, now the key thing is, you know, institutionalization, coordination. See, socialists were very good at this kind of thing. If you're probably too young to remember, but one of the things the Soviet Union always did was to sort of export its people to places like Mozambique and Cuba and so forth, you know, to organize, right? They did a lot of that kind of stuff. And in fact, if you read what Lenin has to say about imperialism early in the 20th century, there's a sense in which imperialism, especially the British imperialism, where you send your own people to sort of colonize the place, is kind of the model on which the Soviets were operating with regard to the idea of world communism. You know, so there's this kind of love, as always is the case with Marxism, there's this love-hate relationship with capitalism, where capitalism, in a sense, really does kind of lay out some of the fundamental infrastructure issues. They kind of get some of those really right. The problem is the content, okay? But some of the formal elements are correct. And so you read Lenin on imperialism, and you begin to see, you know, where you get this idea of a kind of world communist expansion where you're sending your people out. And that's the key. See, I think social media, in one way, can make this easier, of course. But I think the problem is that the ease of social media makes this seem too easy. So there's an issue of follow-through, right? And this is the thing the socialists did have, right? Follow-through. And I think this is the problem at the moment. I mean, I would recommend, you know, interesting, you may have seen this on the BBC World Service, Stephen Sacker, who does Heart Talk, interviewed the Russian guy who was a banker who's bankrolling Occupy Wall Street, Vlad something or another. He was in, you didn't realize that, but there is this kind of guy who seems to be born in Russia who is a banker, and he bankrolls all the young guy, kind of maybe 40 years old, and he was interviewed by Stephen Sacker about, you know, the future of Occupy Wall Street. And the problem with this guy is he has no sense of where you go beyond just getting the Twitters alive, you know? I mean, so in other words, there's no institutional imagination here yet.
I mean, all the ports on the West Coast were closed down today.
I understand there's a lot of opposition, but the socialist makes this too, right? I mean,
open the discussion.
Sorry, yeah.
Yes.
I'm interested in this kind of being a fiend and cultivating enemies notion. And I'd kind of like to draw back to a previous lecture you did, in which you kind of spoke about the conflict of the faculties.
Yeah,
and sciences. Mm-hmm. And you framed it around the ancients and moderns.
Yeah.
Kind of notion, where the kind of ancients look to the past as providing exemplars and to knowledge and return back to the original state. Of kind of wisdom now, and the moderns who believe that truth lies in the future.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of great phrase that really touches the point, and that knowledge now is a rough draft, successive.
Yeah.
And where ethereal book is not a sacred text.
That's right.
But therefore, you know, kind of embracing enemies really does move things on. It's about, you know,
yes,
a template for future
development.
Exactly. Everything else. And being a fiend also does that same.
Yeah.
But at what point, particularly for those in academia, at what point do they stop defending it? Because it fails to...
I think, look, there are a couple of issues here. Sometimes your opponents convince you of things. Let's not deny that. In a sense, you object to things for a certain period of time, but then after a while, you realize this is not something worth arguing about. In a sense, they've made their point. I think the way we need to think of ourselves as people... See, again, I have this kind of general Hegelian view that we are all players on the stage of world history, and we come in and we kind of do our roles as best we can. But the thing is, we have to figure out what that role is as inside, right? You know, at the moment. And it seems to me that you have to see how much you can actually get out of the role, right? How much can you get out of what you're about what you're defending at the moment, okay? And this will have a lot to do with whether people are getting the message. You know, so for example, the intelligent design stuff. It looks like I might be on
BBC One Big Questions on early January, where they're going to have a whole thing on, is there evidence for God? And they're going to look at all different sorts of evidence, and they might want to bring me on for this. As long as there's kind of an issue there, right, worth arguing about, and there are different